This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Andrea Seabrook in Washington. Neil Conan is away. A year ago, many believed America would never elect a non-white president. Then came November 4th. From Times Square to Michigan Avenue to Hollywood Boulevard, crowds flooded the streets as news outlets announced Barack Obama would be the 44th president of the United States. Now, since the jubilations have simmered down, some have begun to ponder, what does this mean for race relations in America? Today, we talk to two African-American journalists who've reappraised the way they think about how the other sees us, how we see them, and what we should expect from one another. Later in the hour, we'll talk with Howard Dean about leaving the Democratic National Committee. First, re-examining race relations in a post-November 4th world. What about you? Has the election made you rethink the way you see others? How has it changed the way you live? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. The email address is talk@npr.org. And you can join the conversation online. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. We begin with Dawn Turner Trice. She writes about race relations for the Chicago Tribune. And she joins us from member station WBEC in Chicago. Welcome.
Hello, Andrea.
One of your most recent posts was about encountering a man who decided he was going to drop the hyphen in the word African-American. Is he dropping African as well? Tell me about this man.
Well, absolutely. I met him over the weekend at a big celebration that a local Chicago suburb had celebrating its diversity. And he said to me that he was going to drop the hyphen and the qualifier and become simply American. In the past, he felt like he kind of sat on the fringes of American culture, and with America having such a tortured past with race relations, he said he really never felt fully a part of the fabric. But that 44% of white Americans could come out and elect a man of color president, he said it really made him rethink how he felt about himself and how he felt about his country.
Barack Obama got more of the white vote than John Kerry did, more than Al Gore did, more than Bill Clinton did.
Absolutely.
So I realize you turn this around to your readers.
Yes.
You asked your readers, has Obama's win made you feel more wholly American? And you asked white Americans as well if they feel they're part of a, quote, more perfect union where race is concerned. What did you hear from your readers?
Well, one white woman from St. Louis told me that she'd grown up in a Chicago suburb, in a very segregated town in Chicago, and she had very provincial views. But Obama inspired her to give money, and she never thought that she would be able to vote for a black man. And then on election day, she said that she worked at a polling place for him, and she was working there with blacks and whites in the spirit of coming together for a common purpose was just so amazing. She said that the next day she immediately went out and approached a black coworker whom she had been wanting to talk to, just to start a conversation and to kind of further those good feelings. She said to me that it wasn't enough to just feel good coming up to the election, but she wanted to carry those feelings beyond the election. There was another man, a young white Republican man, who said that he was disappointed that his party hasn't been able to attract young voters or people of color. He said that he had never been politically active, but he was going to go to work to make sure that the Republican Party looked more like the country. He lives in Michigan. He had grown up in Chicago. And on the South Side, in a very diverse neighborhood, and he said that he was going to join some type of young Republican group or something to make a difference in his party to make sure that it is more racially diverse.
Now, I don't mean to be the jaded journalist here, but it seems as though, especially Barack Obama supporters, are in this sort of starry-eyed period, and seeing the world as this happy, let's all hold hands place. How is this going to translate into action? What's your guess, and what are people telling you?
Well, the guy that I just talked about, the Republican man, said he voted for McCain, so he was not one of the starry-eyed Obama supporters, but he did want to take some of those sentiments and apply them to his party. You know, it's hard to tell how this is going to develop, you know, weeks from now we have an economy that's kind of lurching along, and often in times of economic peril, some of the social issues kind of fall to the side. But there are people who have been out front and working on diversity issues, whether they were fair housing people. I've heard from them as well, who have said, you know, they feel kind of a bit affirmed since Obama's election, that they've been trying to push mixed race communities for some time. So you have people who have been doing a lot of different types of work toward diversity, and who feel buoyed by all of this, and they feel like they will just continue to work harder. Now, how other people how this will manifest later on, it's not clear.
We definitely want to hear from our listeners about how their lives have changed, their perspectives have changed since November 4th. 800-989-8255 is the number. Let's go first to, Deep T in Chicago, Illinois. Hi, you're on Talk of the Nation.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. And I do come from Barako land, so I'm very happy. And it has changed a lot. I come from Indian background, and it has never been a criteria in our country whether you are look whiter or blacker, or you are of certain religion or certain economic level. It has never been the issue. But since I came here 5 years ago with a little girl who goes to a very homogenized society, a school is very homogenized. So for her, it has been a struggle, and it breaks my heart that though whatever you say, this country is still a bit of polarized, but since mm-hmm. Barack Obama got elected, and she also got into the student council, I think she's extremely confident, and whether it changes anything for me or not, I'm very happy that it has changed her outlook, that not only that she can become a doctor, attorney, or whatever as we are, stereotype being Indian, she can also be a successful politician.
Well, thank you so much for your call. Is this the sort of thing that you're hearing, Dawn Turner Trice?
Absolutely. I think, you know, sometimes we try to imagine what are some of the big cataclysmic things that will come out of this. But we can't underestimate the power of the small or not so small internal changes that people are undergoing right now. I mean, the media has such a huge impact on image and the way we see ourselves. And for little boys and girls of all colors and races and religions, I think that Barack Obama really starts to change the model of some things, and so I think that's a huge step. It says a lot for a number of different types of people, but especially I think little maybe black boys and black girls.
What piece does Barack Obama's speech on race that he gave back in the spring? What does that play now that this man is going to be the president of the United States?
Well, I think that for when he was talking, Obama was talking about Reverend Wright and how he understood the challenges that of the 1960s Barack did, and how he understood why there were some older people who were still disheartened by those memories. And he said something about how the problem with that thinking was that they considered things to be fairly static as opposed to capable of change. And I think that was the thing that really resonated with me. And it wasn't just that older generation, but there were those of us in our late 30s or 40s who also kind of stumbled into that line of thinking and that maybe, you know, America was this place where you had some finite growth, or if that's not contradictory. Mm-hmm. But and then I think that when you started to see what was happening in the primary, you looked at some of your friends or people who maybe weren't your friends, but they were white, and they were just so engaged and really saying things that you just did. I live in Chicago, and it's I live outside of Chicago, but I work in Chicago, and really this you don't find many racially polarized, more racially polarized cities mm-hmm. than Chicago. And you started hearing people kind of switching over or saying things that you never expected. Then I think that it was evidence that maybe the whole race condition wasn't as static as many of us had had once thought.
Yeah, what strikes me about Barack Obama's speech back in the spring, now that this man will be president of the United States, is that he spoke about how his own white grandmother confessed to him at one point that she felt nervous when she was walking down the street alone and would pass a black man on the street. And now that there is the option, at least in people's psyche, that that black man could be the president of the United States passing you on the street. It wasn't even an option before.
That's right. And I believe that John H. Johnson, the founder of Ebony Magazine, he understood the importance of image and how you have to be able to see, no matter who you are, you have to be able to see so many different diverse versions of yourself. And to be able to understand that, yes, there is still a lot of young black girls and boys who are in peril, who are in communities that are not faring well. But at the same time, the invisible part of that of the black race that we often don't see are the people who have achieved. And Barack Obama is not alone in this. There are a lot of people of African Americans who have succeeded and who are succeeding.
So, did this election, in your view, become about race, or did it transcend race and become about the man?
Well, I think it was definitely a referendum on race, because, I mean, from the very beginning, from January when Barack won Iowa and won the Iowa caucuses, and it was just it started me to reevaluating the way that I saw race in America. And as someone who has written about race and has thought quite a bit about it, I was just absolutely floored that a state that's overwhelmingly white would could choose in open caucuses, so you're not afraid to say this in front of your neighbor, but could choose a man of color.
Well, ask you more about that, especially reevaluating race in America. We're talking about what's changed in race relations since the election. How is this playing out in your life, if at all? 800-989-8255. You can also send us an email. The address is talk@npr.org. I'm Andrea Seabrook. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Andrea Seabrook in Washington. According to Gallup, more than two-thirds of Americans say Barack Obama's election as president is either the most important advance for black people in the past century or among the top two or three most important advances. The question now, what's changed in race relations since November 4th? Calvin Weary is a dark-skinned man that lives in a mostly pro-McCain area in York, Pennsylvania, where he worries about the other.
Do they think that I'm pulling out in front of their car because now I think that I can get away with it? Or are they realizing I'm just a jerk when I drive? I'm hoping that I'm not adding to any anxiety they might be feeling, since where I live basically voted for McCain.
Michelle Norris of All Things Considered and Steve Inskeep of Morning Edition have been talking with a diverse group of voters in York, Pennsylvania about race. Their third and final conversation following Barack Obama's election airs on both of those shows tomorrow. Did your perception of race relations change after last Tuesday night? How has your life changed? Give us a call. It's 1-800-989-8255. The email address is talk@npr.org. And you can join the conversation online. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. Now, this hour, we were hoping to speak with Ta-Nehisi Coates. He's a contributing editor at The Atlantic, but we haven't been able to get him on the line. And we're sticking with our best person, Dawn Turner Trice. She's a columnist at the Chicago Tribune. And before the break, you were saying that this whole election, beginning with the Iowa caucuses, has made you personally reevaluate race in America.
Absolutely. I couldn't put my finger on what I was feeling exactly for a long time until I heard a young white woman say, and she said these words, she said, We see ourselves in him. And she was speaking of Obama. And I figured, oh my God, that's what's been kind of tripping me up a bit. Because in some ways, we Americans see ourselves in our president, and that so many white people in a country with such a tortured history regarding race could see themselves in a man of color. that was astounding, and that was something that I never thought that I would see in my lifetime.
I definitely want to hear from more of our callers. Let's go to Angela. She's in South Bend, Indiana. Hi there.
Hi. How are you?
Very good.
I love Talk of the Nation. I'm so glad that we're having this discussion. Trying to keep it brief. There's just so much that I have to comment. The only thing that I'm an African-American woman. I am 25. So I'm in that demographic that I guess is, you know, starry-eyed Barack Obama supporter. But living in Indiana, driving past a field of cows as we speak, actually. I live in the city, but I work kind of rural, and so does my boyfriend. And we are both surrounded by McCain supporters. It was amazing that Indiana went blue after 44 years. But the attitude is kind of tense now. It was tense to begin with. It started out when before he was selected as the Democratic nominee. You know, it was joking. It was a little lighthearted. It was, you know, wow, this is history. There's a woman and a black man, you know, blah, blah, blah. And there were jokes around our coworkers. But eventually, as it looked as if he would actually become the nominee, things got a little more tight-lipped. Literally, my boyfriend didn't really have lunch with any of his coworkers. He ate alone. He's one of the three African-Americans that works in his entire factory. There were, you know, postings up on bulletin boards about the otherness of Barack Obama, about, you know, how he's Muslim, the rumors, blah, blah, blah. And then eventually it came down to even some people that he would speak with that were Republican, they would admit, you know, some things that Barack Obama were proposing, some of his ideas, they made sense to them, but they just couldn't vote for him. And they wouldn't really, you know, say why. It was like this hint. And also to comment on what your guest was saying earlier, about how older generations could, you know, they're still a little apprehensive, thinking, you know. I have my grandmother, and I work with older African Americans, and their thought was, I hope he's not assassinated. It's like this country would never tolerate a black man as a leader. Yeah, we have this afterglow and everyone's happy, but when it comes down to the nitty gritty, a year, 2 years from now, you know, there's still that threat. It's just kind of a downer.
Angela, let me ask you, you're talking about how you feel you're seen as a black woman, you and your boyfriend. How about, do you see whites differently?
I don't. I did on election night, and maybe the night after. I actually was at a friend's house for an election day party. We were all Obama supporters. They were mostly white. And they, you know, we were crying and holding each other at the same time. That made me feel proud as an American. And that did make me feel like, okay, now things are going to be a little bit even. But after that, and after speaking with black people, actually, not white people, I mean, it's a little tense around work with the older white people that I work with. And I would like to chalk that up to, you know, disappointment that their candidate didn't win. But in speaking with older black people, their whole thing, I mean, I've even heard, you know, well, watch out, there's going to be more speeding tickets in Indiana now for black people, because there are going to be some angry cops that are going to racially profile because black man is in president, as a president, and now this is their way of retaliation. I mean, retaliation is a feeling around here.
Thanks for your call, Angela. And Dawn Trice Turner, what do you think of this? Is this the sort of thing that you're hearing from your readers as well?
No, it's interesting, because coming from Chicago, and we all kind of, we remembered when Harold Washington, the city's first black mayor, was elected, and the day after that election was just incredibly tense. The whole election, the campaign was so racially polarized that, I mean, those of us who remembered that time, we were kind of, you know, we weren't certain what to expect the day after November 4th. And I have not heard readers, I haven't heard that from readers, and I have not seen that here in Chicago. And hadn't heard much of it from readers in Indiana, but I can understand the caller's perspective. Because, I mean, there is that, you know, we have the kumbaya side of the story. But there were people who voted for Obama, even, who wouldn't want to live next door to him, and or who wouldn't want to sit next to him in a pew. But they voted their interests, you know. So this whole issue is very complicated.
Let's go to Kai in Surprise, Arizona. Is that right?
That's right.
tell me what your comments are.
Well, I'm a teacher, and I'm African American, and all of my students are white. I had, when I first started teaching at this school, I love the school. It's a wonderful school. And I work with students with behavioral disorders. That the parents, I had several parents who did not want to shake my hand. Mm. I had parents that, and this was about 5 years ago, and I had a parent that wanted to see my credentials because they really didn't believe that I was capable of teaching their child. But what's happened is, in the last few years, even before this, is that they realized that I had their child's interest in mind and that we have to work together. Now, what that has done as far as acceptance on a political realm, I would have to say it's minimal. They just identify me as, well, I was identified by one parent as that nigger teacher. Ooh. And that parent is now extremely apologetic and one of my biggest fans. But in terms of support and working together, they are working together with me. But again, as far as on the political scene, I'm in McCain country, and it's very difficult to see very much changing on a larger scale.
Thanks very much for your call. We also have an email that's come in from Christy in St. Louis, Missouri. She says, I'm hearing and seeing from some of the white community in my area that the guilt that white people are supposed to have about slavery to black people is over because now we have a black president. Do you think this takes a step in that direction, Dawn Turner Trice?
Well, I never liked the thought of white guilt, but during the Democratic National Convention, I wrote a story for the newspaper about whether a black president would mean that there would no longer be any need for groups like the NAACP or the Urban League or maybe even policies such as affirmative action. And the reality is that we definitely have come a long way, but there's still a long way to go. And I think that it's just important to keep that in mind. When I look around Chicago and look at the things that are happening in various impoverished communities that are mostly black, you realize that it's huge that there is a black man who's been elected president, but there is still so much work that has to be done.
What about expectations? I mean, what are some of the expectations that, say, white people have of blacks now after this election? And vice versa.
Well, I think that there is the expectation that we or they or black people as a whole should be able to look at Barack Obama, and this is kind of a huge expectation, and be able to perform accordingly, you know, to understand that it's okay to do well in school. Some of those cliches about just standing up and being better citizens. And the reality is that there are lots of African Americans who are doing that already. The expectations, I think, are high across the board. There are lots of expectations from the black community and from other communities.
Let's go to Joe in Little Rock, Arkansas. Joe, you're on Talk of the Nation.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to sing a little kumbaya from my perspective. I'm a 40-year-old white guy, and I work in sales, and it's pretty predominantly white industry, but I have a highly educated, highly sophisticated African-American woman as a coworker, and we went to lunch the other day. And while it was in the back of my mind, I never once mentioned race, never once mentioned how fortunate for all of my coworkers, family and friends and of the African-American race that Barack Obama won. That wasn't anything near the subject matter. And my point, of course, is that I think in our actions we can show that race is less of an issue as much as we can in our words.
Interesting. It kind of harkens back to the older style of talking about race, which was attempting to be colorblind.
Yes, and that's how I've raised my kids. You know, we don't use the word black as a descriptive. You know, there's a movie, Cinderella, with Brandy as the lead, and we talk about what we like about the movie and what we like about the Cinderella, but we never ever have taught them to use color of skin as a descriptive.
You know, I wonder, though, if I could just ask you, that's sort of been, there are some people who say America's gotten beyond that, that talking about race is better than not talking about race, and that it's only white people that ascribe to this idea of colorblindness.
Well, I think it's time for both sides.
Okay.
And I also think that, I'm not avoiding the issue. Clearly, there's a bit of a paradox there, because it is an issue. And I'm, of course, in Arkansas, which is, there are a lot of racial strains here, but I've had the fortunate opportunity to live in the Pacific Northwest for 14 years, where there's less of an issue.
So you
just bring your experience back to the South, and I'm willing to talk about it. I'm absolutely thrilled to share my perspective, but I think just going to a movie with a friend who's of a different color or race, doesn't have to be African American, and just really showing that there's not really a divide there, it can be very powerful.
Joe, thank you so much for your call. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Dawn Turner Trice, what do you think of what this caller was just saying?
Well, I've always, my personal feeling about that is that I really don't have a problem if someone notices that I'm African American or black. I'm also 5'10" tall, and so if you notice that, that's not a problem for me either. But the challenge is to not ascribe some of the negative feelings you have about my brownness, my blackness, just based on meeting me for that first impression. So it's like, don't hold it against me. And that's always, that's been the challenge. So I think it's interesting because we have a 13 and a half year old daughter, and she's growing up in a racially diverse community. And it's interesting how, you know, she won't describe her friends as being Asian or black or white. They're just her friends. And so it's her parents who from time to time will say, well, is she black or is she white? You know, and then she'll kind of, you know, Mom, what difference does that make? So it's that generational divide, too, that, you know, that we're guilty of.
We've got a call here from Ronnie in Cincinnati. He writes, I'm a 30-something African-American male. When passing groups of whites, I would wonder who the closet racist is. Now I wonder who the closet Obama supporter is. A great option to introduce to my psyche. This election means I can no longer allow automatically label anyone anything.
Absolutely.
It's interesting. Let's go to one more caller, Dwayne in Columbus. Hi, you're on Talk of the Nation.
Hello there.
Hi.
I love the show, and thanks for having me.
Great. Go ahead with your comment.
You know, my comment is that I live in a very predominantly Caucasian area of southern Kansas, and the feeling that I and my friends have had really after Obama was elected is an immense feeling of pride in being American at this point that we've not really got to feel before now. And you know, my entire friend group is white, other than myself, and I'm mixed race. But notably, you know, I'm very brown in color, so obviously I would be judged as African American. But my white friends have a huge sense of pride.
And do you? So this has changed you? You think?
Yeah. You know, my feelings and my sentiment, I think, have changed a lot. I mean, really, just unbeknownst pride.
So will it translate into actions? Do you think?
Now, the area that I specifically live in, I don't know if there will be much change here, being that I am in such a small community that's so predominantly white. I don't think it'll change here, but I think on a national spectrum, I think we're going to see a lot of change and advancement of colored people.
Thank you very much, Dwayne, for calling in.
Thanks a lot.
And a last word to you then, Dawn Turner Trice, do you think that this carries more meaning for people of white than colored?
You know, that's interesting, and that's kind of the way I posed the question on the website the other day, because I realized it wasn't just about the changes or the internal changes that African Americans or any other people of color, how they were feeling, but it's also how white people were feeling as well. And I think that is that there are a lot of people who have felt that. I mean, how do you show or tell somebody that, you know, that I'm not a racist or that I want to get to know you on a level that's more than superficial. And the election was a way, I think, on a national scale that a lot of white people probably felt like, well, this is the way that we were able to do that, to convey that message.
Dawn mm-hmm. Turner Trice. She writes about race relations for the Chicago Tribune, and she joined us from member station WBEZ in Chicago. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, after a big win for Democrats, Howard Dean plans to step down as the head of the DNC. We'll give him an exit interview. I'm Andrea Seabrook. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Now, it wasn't just President-elect Obama. Last Tuesday was a good day for the whole Democratic Party. They'll now have a more solid majority in the House under Speaker Nancy Pelosi. And in the Senate, Democrats came very close to the number they need to block filibusters. The party picked up seats in Oregon, Colorado, New Mexico, Virginia, North Carolina, and New Hampshire. The man who led the Democratic National Committee to those victories, former Vermont governor and presidential candidate himself, Howard Dean. When he took over the chairmanship of the DNC, Dean implemented what he called the 50-state strategy. It was a bold new initiative to find fresh Democratic candidates and novel ways of campaigning all across the country. Now, not everybody was on board with Dean's plans, but it appears that his strategy worked. We're talking to Howard Dean for the rest of this hour. If you want to talk to him about the 2008 campaign, the election, the future of the Democratic Party, give us a call. Our number is 800-989-8255. You can also send us an email. It's talk@npr.org. Howard Dean joins us now from the Democratic National Committee headquarters here in Washington. It's good to have you with us, Governor Dean.
Andrea, thanks for having me on.
Now, it's reported that you won't be seeking another term as chairman of the DNC. Why?
It's the prerogative of the new president to name their own chair. There is an election, but the election is generally uncontested, and I think we ought to continue that tradition. President-elect Obama is going to be sworn in on the 20th of January, and I suspect around the 21st of January he will have a chair that he chooses to run the Democratic National Committee.
Let's talk about some of the results that came through last Tuesday. You must be pleased. How much credit do you claim for what happened?
Well, we claim some. I mean, it helps to have an extraordinary candidate. Everybody always says this is the most important election of our lifetime. Well, whoever's alive now is going to be able to say that 2008 was the most important election in their lifetime, no matter how many elections they go through. They had the best team that I've ever seen run a presidential campaign on the Democratic side. There have been some good campaigns. I take nothing away from Bill Clinton's 1992 campaign, for example, which was extraordinary. But there were no leaks. There was no drama. People got along. There was extraordinary discipline. When you have that for a campaign, it makes a big difference. But what we did that was so helpful was we got the Democrats to stop playing this idea that you were going to get 50% plus one of the electoral votes. The Democratic message when I became chairman was essentially being carried by people like Bill O'Reilly and Rush Limbaugh, because there were no Democrats that would stand up and speak for the Democratic point of view and Democratic values in places like Utah or even Nevada sometimes. The first calculation we made was, one, the road to the White House leads through the West. We didn't know we were going to have a candidate like Barack Obama who could win in Florida and Ohio. So we decided we would find a way to win without Florida and Ohio. And the solution was that Nevada, Arizona, we didn't know we were going to have Senator McCain either. So Arizona was on the table, New Mexico, Colorado, I think I mentioned Nevada, and Montana. That we could win those states, that we wouldn't have to win Florida or Ohio. Then we decided to contest every single state. The 50-state strategy does not mean we put $10 million into Utah with 3 weeks to go. What it means is you have a Democratic presence there, you work hard and you support elected officials there, and you have up-to-date technology. We put $40,000 into every state every year to make sure they have a voter file that's all worked on the same principles. We have a national voter file, which we never had before. We have all the commercial information that the Republicans had for 15 years. We figured out how to use that and identify voters. we have a national party again because we've competed in every single state.
But the party's leadership, especially in Congress, wasn't all for the 50-state strategy, and they had good reasons not to be.
Their job is different than mine. Their job was to get as many people elected as they could in 2006, and they did a very good job. But my job is to build a long-term business plan for so that Democrats can win elections when times are good, and so we can win elections where times are not so good. And so we did actually help them a lot. We borrowed money. We gave them some. We had people at staff in the states. Many of the seats that were picked up in red states that George Bush had won. And the reason was for example, in Kansas, the governor of Kansas assigned some staff to a woman she thought was terrific, and that person ultimately was running a neck-and-neck race. And when the DCCC realized that they needed those races, they were able to put lots of money into those races in the last 3 weeks because they were close, and we won. So it's a joint effort, and, you know, there's always lots of Sturm und Drang that goes on in Washington, but the fact is we all work together. And we came up with a huge result in 2006, and then, of course, we hit the jackpot in 2008.
Mm-hmm. Governor Dean, I want to hear from some of our callers. They are eager to ask you questions. This is Steve in St. Louis, Missouri.
Steve? Hi, Governor Dean. I live in St. Louis County and have not really been involved in the political process until this election, when I volunteered many, many, many weekends to the Obama campaign. And I found it just a great experience because I wasn't given talking points or told what to do. I was just able to go and connect with people and tell my story and why I wanted to be involved. But I'm concerned because after spending all of those weekends, I just found it so easy. I mean, to be honest, I haven't been back to the office, the Obama campaign, since the election because I've been so busy. So I wanted to know what the party is planning to do to make sure that volunteers and people who have been so committed to this election don't just, you know, every 4 years think that they can, after the election, just tuck things away and go back to their daily lives. And
that is unbelievably important. It's a point I make, particularly to young people. Elections are not every 4 years. Politics is permanent. You always have to be involved in permanent politics. And if it's not doing what you did over the weekends and talking to people all the time, then it's being involved in your community. It's working in mayor's races. It's running for the city council, not just in a big city like St. Louis, but in the smaller places, Kirkwood and so forth. So I do believe that, look, President Obama, elect Obama's campaign believes in empowering people. That's what their campaign was all about. That's what we believe in at the DNC. So I'd be surprised if there was a fundamental shift in strategy as President-elect Obama takes over the workings of the DNC. First of all, they've pretty much controlled the workings of the DNC since the day he was really became the nominee in June sometime. I have confidence in these folks. I've worked side by side with them. The description of what you just said, that they let you empower people by going out and giving your own reasons for why you voted, wanted to vote that way, that's exactly what we have been encouraging people to do. The only question left in the air is what they want to do about staffing state parties, and that's that we've staffed them for 4 years. Not all of them. All the state parties, we've paid for certain staff and certain upgrades to their technology. That question is going to now be up to the Obama folks. But this is completely consistent with everything they did during the campaign, so I think you're going to see most likely a continuation of the basic strategy.
Steve, thanks very much for your call.
Thank you.
I want to ask you about a particular issue that it seemed like both sides kind of skirted around, and that is immigration. We have an email here from Al in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. He says, considering mass deportations and families being torn apart every day, I would like to ask Howard Dean if he would encourage the next Congress and President Obama to come back to comprehensive immigration reform bill within the next year.
I know that that is the Obama administration's intention, but I doubt that it's going to happen in the first year. Look, we have been overtaken by the worst economic crisis since the 1930s, and I think that's going to be job one for everybody as soon as President Obama takes the oath. He's working very hard now to name his economic team. That comes first. It's clearly his first priority. I think mass deportations have really not gone on. We don't want them to go on. That makes no sense. It's not good for the economy. President-elect Obama has spoken out about that during the campaign. But secondly, I would agree with the caller. We absolutely have to have immigration, comprehensive immigration reform. Barack Obama's on record favoring that. But I do think that we're going to need a little time for this one, because we have to do, as he said, we have to deal with the economy. We have to deal with renewable energy and health care. Those are all crucial, both security and economic issues. And then there's lots of other things we've got to deal with as well, and that's certainly one of them.
Governor Dean, a question from Dean in Portland, Oregon. He asks, did the recent election disprove the notion, often touted by the Clinton camp, that Democrats could only take control of one of the two branches of government by running as centrists?
You know, one of the things that's remarkable about President-elect Obama is that he's a new generation candidate, and he really is. He's 47 years old. The new generation really cuts off at 35, but he thinks like one of these new generation folks. And what they say, among other things, is let's unite the country and focus on the things that we can work together on and not keep focusing on the things that we disagree on. And one of the byproducts of that, I believe, is that the placement of people in the political spectrum and the verbiage that goes with it is going to become obsolete. I don't think that most young people think of themselves as conservative or liberals or centrist. I think they are inclined towards each other. Evangelicals, for example, under 35, here's their top three issues. One, poverty. Two, climate change. And three, Darfur. Well, I don't know. Is that are those liberal issues or conservative issues? I don't think you would want to say young evangelical Christians are liberals, but... So I think this talk about centrism and conservatism and where you are and the liberalism and all that stuff, I think that's obsolete with a new generation. I think they're issue-focused, and I think they're caring-focused, and I think they're unity-focused. And I don't think they're particularly partisan. I mean, it turns out they voted 66% with the Democrats in the last election, but I think that's because our message resonates. Our message of inclusion and working together in unity resonates so much better with them than the divisive messages that you saw on the other side.
Still, it was said through the campaign that Barack Obama is, quote-unquote, one of the most liberal members of the United States Senate.
Who was it said by? I mean, it was said by people who believe that liberal is a dirty word. As it turns out, Barack Obama is a unifier.
But he's no Joe Lieberman. I mean, he's probably center-left,
I'd say. This is the interesting thing. Now, to stack him up against Joe Lieberman in this comparison is very interesting and it's very apt. Joe really is a centrist, He's also a polarizing figure. His rhetoric was very polarizing. So here you have a centrist, moderate, who's a polarizing figure. Now, whether Barack is a liberal or not, I'll leave up to the pundits, excluding Fox, which, of course, will always say that. But he is a unifier. He is not a polarizing figure at all. No matter where you think he is on the political spectrum, Barack Obama is not a polarizing figure. So here you have a so-called centrist who is a polarizing figure, and then you have a so-called liberal who is not a polarizing figure. That's the difference between the old politics and the new politics. And that we're going to see a lot more of that. I think you're going to find it impossible to say where Barack Obama belongs on the political spectrum. And people my age will be very upset about it. And people his age will think it's great.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's go back to the phones now and talk with Allison in Culpeper, Virginia. Hi, Allison. You're on Talk of the Nation.
Hi. I just wanted to ask about how the campaign. First of all, I'm ecstatic about the decision of the campaign, the results of the election. That's absolutely fabulous. But I became a bit disgruntled with my party, the Democratic Party, about 18 months ago because I felt that... all I was hearing is Hillary, 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 and that they were almost excluding any potential other candidates. And I became very disenfranchised and considered my other options as far as parties. And I just wanted to, since it all ended up great, we have a very unifying president-elect, and I really think the ground troops throughout the 50 states did a tremendous job in getting out the vote. And I just wanted to see if the DNC was aggressively pushing a particular candidate at the beginning, how it would evolve. I mean, I don't want this to be a trend in the future.
We never push a candidate, ever. I was the referee. Around last May, when the campaign was at its hottest point, I think all the Hillary people thought I was with Obama, and all the Obama people thought I was with Hillary. You know, it's our job to stay neutral. And unlike... the senatorial committee and the congressional committee, we don't even pick candidates in primaries. We do not do that. We stay neutral. We want to give everybody a chance because I think the DNC, there has to be one place in the party where everybody feels that they can be treated fairly. And that was is meant to be the Democratic National Committee.
Thanks.
So the reason you heard all that about Hillary is that's what the news media was talking about. And the news media, don't ever confuse the news media with the Democratic National Committee. They do what they have to do, and we work behind the scenes to make sure that everybody has a fair shake.
Right, that's great. I just, you know, my mailbox every day was Hillary this, Hillary that, and that's great. I mean,
but not from us.
Get the word out.
Right. Not from us.
I just wanted to make sure that, you know, I guess my perspective wasn't clear on who was pushing who.
No, we try to stay neutral and give everybody a chance.
Thanks very much for your call, Allison. Let's go to Jean in Cordon, Indiana. Hi.
Yes. Hello.
Go ahead with your question for Governor Dean.
Well, in the Florida primaries and the Michigan primaries, the Florida Republicans moved the date up, and of course that caused the Democrats to say that their votes wouldn't be counted. And then in Michigan, the dates were moved up. And anyhow, I'm looking at the Republican governors meeting in Florida right now, and I'm wondering if the Republican governors decide to try to sabotage the process for the next go-around. Will the DNC just say, well, we won't count those votes, and will we fall prey to their little scheme and they'll be laughing all the time?
Well, good question.
It is a good question. We actually didn't say we won't count the votes. We said we'd like you to adopt a process within the rules, and then the states didn't want to do that, so there was a big flap about it, which ultimately got solved. We are actually working, or we have been under my chairmanship, whether that continues under the new chairman or not, I don't know, but I suspect it will, with the Republican National Committee to resolve the problems that went on in those in the primary discrepancies. The interesting thing is the Republicans had five states that were out of compliance, and they actually never did get their votes back. President-elect Obama caused Michigan and Florida to get their votes back at the convention. But the five states, I think it was Wyoming, I think New Hampshire, Florida, Michigan, I don't remember what the other state was, that violated the Republican side, only had half delegations at the convention. So this clearly has to be worked out, but there has to be rules. So there was a lot of complaining about this when we went through it, that if you set rules and then you change the rules in the middle of the game, it's not fair to one of the candidates.
Governor Dean, what all of our listeners want to know, in a word, what's next for you?
I do not know. but I appreciate the sentiment. Thanks for having me on.
We're so glad to have Governor Howard Dean on. He was the head of the Democratic National Committee. Moving on to the next thing. I'm Andrea Seabrook, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.